Okay, let's start the show.
For Thursday, January 31st? 30th?
No,
there
yes.
It is. It's 30th, 2020. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Welcome to the podcast this week. I'm Norm. We're getting right to it. Jeremy's here.
Hi, Norman.
And Kishore's here.
Hello.
How are you both feeling?
A little under-caffeinated, but it's on the way. Here it comes.
Well, I'm averaging you out because I feel way over-caffeinated. I'm ready to go.
Wow.
I'm so glad neither of you said under the weather with coughs or...
Never.
Never.
It's
okay.
Super Bowl week. I got to be in tip-top shape.
That is so true. If you are the type of person who cares about that, if you fall into the Venn diagram of person who listens to technology podcasts and also cares about football, we have two of them in this room at least, the Super Bowl is this Sunday.
There's a great Ozo Motley song called Super Bowl Sunday. Sunday is spelled like the dessert treat. And I'm telling you, this song embodies more musical genres than any other song I can think of. Like, it's got Indian hip hop, like, it's got some classical. It's great.
I think that's going to be the first and last Ozo Motley reference on Super Bowl week, but I like it. I like it. I'm there with you.
Kishore, as in years past, we've talked about your ritual for Super Bowl. And I don't know, I know you're, actually, I do know this. I know you're not a Niners fan, even though you live in the Bay Area.
You're not?
No.
I'm not from San Francisco.
No,
affiliation to the 49ers.
No.
You like the Steelers.
Oh, my goodness. You get one more guess.
I like the Steelers, fine.
Where is Kishore from?
Pittsburgh. Isn't that the Steelers?
Oh, that's where God. I grew up. I was born in...
Buffalo.
Oh, I didn't
Buffalo.
Know that.
Buffalo! Yeah. He's a Bills fan, there and the Bills is. Did very well this season. Unfortunately, did not quite make it, although... Good luck next season.
I think everyone can hear my face right now.
His bemusement. But in the Bay Area, we are very excited because it is the 49ers.
There's Niners fever. Like, you pass by almost like every gas station. There are like stands out in front signing Niners gear. Yes.
Target's got a whole aisle for
used
it.
Used car lots are sold out of those bandwagons.
Nice.
Everyone is on board.
Are TV sales up?
You know that... everyone says Super Bowl is a time to buy TVs. It's not. It's when the ads certainly ramp up. You hear on the radio, you see a pop up like, buy your TVs. Super Bowl, let's put it out there. Super Bowl is the time, like late January, early February, is when TV manufacturers are trying to get rid of stock from last year's supply so they, in the summer, can start rolling out new stock of TVs that they unveiled at CES.
Mm-hmm. You wait about 2 or 3 weeks, the stock they're trying to get rid of right now will go even lower.
Exactly. This is their big sales rush for them to try to clear out stock, but the prices can always go down. And it's unless you need... Who's going to... It's such like a cliche, right? That Super Bowl's coming up. It's 2 weeks away. Then people are going to buy a new TV. You got to go and get it set up so that the friends can come over.
Get that 240 hertz motion smoothing on.
Yeah. Does that actually happen?
I'm just watching the Super Bowl in cinema mode. I don't know what you're talking about. Filmmaker mode for a Super Bowl.
I hear my phone, the iPhone 11 has better audio. I can watch it on the phone. Now it's on the apps. Everyone's, you know, people who are watching it or following it on their phones and watching it on their phones.
Can you watch the Super Bowl with no commentary?
Yeah, it's called a mute button.
No, I want sound. I just want the field. I want the players. I want the crunching.
Oh, you mean like
I want to be in the stand, you know, in the stands. It's plural, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, certain apps, like for example, for baseball, for MLB, when the World Series comes around, and if you subscribe to the MLB app, you can get not only the national broadcast feed, but you can also get multiple angles. And it's a kind of like a version of the mixing room where the broadcast room gets, you know, the feeds. You don't get as many as, you know, the dozens of feeds that they get, and you're not mixing yourself, but you do get maybe four.
Sounds good.
And those you don't get necessarily the broadcast audio. Mm-hmm. just get the camera feed.
So a new like invention over the past couple of years is the analyst feed, where you're watching the game, and instead of the regular commentators, it's like ex players like breaking down the plays as they're happening. I don't think that's for me.
I'm sure there are people who spin up Twitch feeds or Mixer feeds and just let you listen, and maybe you can create some type of sync delay where some expert is giving commentary that you can listen to while watching Super. You can get the stadium sounds, but you might not have to listen to Joe Buck, right? What I would love to listen to is the feeds that are going into the broadcast announcer's ears from the behind the scenes analysts, right? Yes, I do believe that Troy Aikman knows his football, but they're also being fed information, stats from a team of analysts, a support team, that's maybe even on the sidelines getting you know, new info.
Can I tell you one thing that's sort of irritating me? What's commercials for the Super Bowl are coming out early now.
Why not? They spent a lot of money on them. They're going to get attention now.
What's the point? Well, they're going to get attention that day too.
But they spent so much money making the commercial and so much money on the placement that it, you know, if you do the math, it's easier for them to get earlier attention because they've had this brand. They are a Super Bowl ad, and they can put them out online and get the views. They can put them out, you know, they can buy time into the week, the Super Bowl week.
Smart Park. You seen it?
What's that?
Smart Park.
Is that the new thing?
Yeah, like John Krasinski, is that his name? Mm-hmm. And
Captain America.
Chris Evans?
Yeah. And a woman from SNL. They're all together.
Kate McKinnon.
Having a good time, and it's fantastic. They all do a Boston accent, and the car parks itself. You're familiar with parking itself, probably.
Of course, yeah.
But apparently Tesla's not the only game in town anymore.
Oh, so it's a car ad?
Yeah.
It's a car ad. They're enjoying the car parking itself.
Smart
and
park.
They're sitting in the car. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. It's good stuff.
Yeah. movie studios are not spending a ton of money buying movie ads anymore. They get much more mileage out of just releasing the trailer on social media and releasing it on YouTube than it would necessarily try to buy a 15-second spot.
I mean, there is no like massive movie this year. There's no Endgame type movie that has that kind of budget to blow on a Super Bowl ad.
I mean, Marvel could for Black Widow, but I don't know if they're going to.
I don't think they need to.
So tell me about the wings, Kishore.
Oh, yeah. So I have a annual Super Bowl wing party. Because of the bandwagon of the 49ers, we have a record number of people coming to the party this year.
Ooh.
So that means we have a record poundage of wings.
Wow.
I think we might go up to 60 pounds of wings this year.
That is a big bag of wings.
That is a small child worth of wings.
Wow.
That's a big child.
Yeah, that's a fairly large child. 7 flavors this year. I have one utmost recommendation, and this is seconded by our own Joey Famille. Ferment your own hot sauce. Revelation, people. It's so easy to do. You do a lacto fermentation. You essentially leave it out and use bacteria from the air to ferment chilies. I used Fresno chilies and vinegar, let them ferment. It added so much depth of flavor, and it was so easy to do. Easily one of my most recommended kitchen variants that can bring a ton of flavor. So I would my first fermented hot sauce.
I would try that wing first. That sounds delicious. But
I made a standard buffalo sauce out of it.
Do you really think that it's not just a matter of it tastes good because you made it? Because hot sauce, I would imagine, doesn't need to be fresh. Am I wrong?
What?
Okay.
It's controversy. You're not invited to this party, Jeremy.
No,
wings for you. And you double fry the wings?
Yeah, we par-bake the wings ahead of time, like that morning, and then flash fry them at 400 in peanut oil to finish them so they're extra crispy. And then I individually dress wings to order.
How far down the hot ones track could you make it? All the way?
Oh, I mean, I can make it, but I find, so I've done the hot ones challenge.
Yeah.
It's just not, like, most of the sauces at the high end of the spectrum.
No, it's not fun.
Are just not enjoyable. Like, you don't get any other flavor besides hot.
Yeah, it's hot.
Get this. I learned this. Hot is not a flavor. It's just a pain.
Pain.
So, anyways, I think there's...
Wait. Are you saying that the flavor that you get in hot sauce, there is potentially a way to get that flavor without the pain.
Yeah, I think there's a good mix of pain to flavor ratio that creates a really delightful experience that pairs well with the fattiness of a chicken wing. And when you go beyond that, when you just go into pure pain, it becomes really hard to taste anything else besides feeling that pain. And so I think there's a lot of really delicious hot sauces that have been featured on Hot Ones. A few of those have actually inspired wings this year. But once you get past like their 8 out of 10 rating on that site, I think you lose any sense of flavor.
Science, what I need you to do is help me separate the flavor from the pain, because I just want the flavor.
Mm-hmm. I'm with
don't
you.
Don't want the pain. I'm not going to
have
there.
A little bit of pain.
I want something that I can just dial just the pain level I want, but then have full flavor.
Just a little bit of peril.
Just a little bit. I'm not going to be there, unfortunately. I'll be actually on an airplane on Sunday, flying to Florida, where the Super Bowl is, but not to Miami, where also the Super Bowl is specifically. I'm going to be in Orlando. So
you joining the resistance?
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I hear it's rising.
Dude, I was really seriously considering a day trip to Disneyland.
I know.
And I gave up because, have you heard?
Yeah.
It's the virtual queue. The virtual queue, in order to ride this new ride, you can't even enter the queue till you're in the park. They let you in the park early.
Is it geotagged or how's
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I don't know. They have the board of the park. Yeah. They know where you are. It's Disney. They know what you have in your pockets.
Okay.
So it's not a problem getting into the park. You just have to be there before like the park officially opens, and you'll probably get a ride. But early on, the entire day would sell out in the first 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Best case scenario, I heard 9:30 a.m. is the cutoff for the entire day in order to ride the new Rise of the Resistance.
And I'm not going on Sunday.
It's been open longer in Disney World, it's running smoother there. So I think you'll have better luck.
And there are more attractions overall in
That's
Walt
true.
Disney World.
Right, exactly.
So the attendance. And also, I do hear that in general, the early February time period is the best time to go.
Yeah, so yeah, January and February both.
All fingers crossed for people wanting to go on the Avatar ride and maybe right. less well, so
you,
much.
You want to do that too?
I want to do that too. I do want to do that
too. We look forward to your reviews.
Yeah, I will come back and give a full report on all the rides. Or I'll come back and say, I didn't get a chance to do any rides because the baby was being difficult.
Don't blame the baby.
Because I'm absolutely going
to
blame the
because
baby.
Because I had to have, you know, I had my fatherly duties.
That's right. That's right. Diapers need to be changed. The Empire won this time. So go Niners, I think I can say.
Go Niners.
And Norm's from the Bay Area. He can legit,
yeah, I watched
legit
that.
Do it.
I remember the last time they won the Super Bowl. I also remember the last time they were in the Super Bowl and lost. But
I remember the last time the Bills.
No. if you're doing Super Bowl squares, Kishore, I want in. We'll take it offline. And I'm going to Venmo you some cash. Get my fix in. Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever done Super Bowl squares?
Probably not strictly legal, whatever you just said.
Oh, super legal.
Is it? Are Super Bowl squares illegal?
I mean, it's gambling,
right? Do you remember?
Bring it on, FBI. I'm waiting. I'll give them a plate of wings. I'll be forgiven instantaneously.
Back in the old Future Media days, when I was 16 years old, Rob Smith of PC Gamer would walk around before Super Bowl weekend and go get people to fill up the Super Bowl squares at, you know, $10 a pop. And I played.
Oh, that rings a bell. I think I did do that.
Right? You put like $10 and you get a square and then like,
yeah.
You know, if you come, I might you come have back won that one. Monday and I then might. They're like, oh, hey, you made $30.
I have a memory of winning something like that. No, I really do. I think I won $100 or something.
There you go.
Wow.
Why knock it?
Yeah.
Don't knock
it. I didn't. This is great.
Fantastic.
Top story this week.
You know, we talked about it a little bit last week, but it has really become not only a national story, but a global story. We are, of course, talking about the coronavirus that is safe to say escalating the crisis in China.
I would say it's a serious issue. It's not one to be panicked about, which is what I said last week. Still feel like that's very true right now. And I think what's most interesting to watch beyond the actual details of the case is this idea of how the global response is organized and the kind of gaps and weaknesses that are exhibited from that, because viruses don't obey borders. And because it is a it's a sign of where we are, and it'll illustrate where we need to go to prevent this in the future.
All right. So for people who did not follow A Moment of Science last week, but maybe have been following the news this past week, where are we at right now?
Yeah. So a 30-second primer on this. So there's a broad class of viruses called coronaviruses. The flu is a version of a coronavirus. SARS was a coronavirus. MERS is a coronavirus. So this specific coronavirus that's spreading in China right now is generally referred to as nCoV-2019. It seems to have originated in some sort of animal or fish market, though we really don't know at this point. It spread to some humans. At the time that we are recording this, there are 6,100 cases that have been identified. 6,000 of them are in China. Of that, 132 people have died. There are cases in, I think, 15 other countries at this point, all in the single digits. The reason it's of concern is there's a lot we don't know about the virus right now in terms of how it's spreading and how quickly it's incubating, the symptoms, and all of those things. I'll get into that into more detail. As it stands, China has essentially quarantined a number of cities in and around the city of Wuhan, where this seems to have originated, where they've closed transportation and all essentially all ingress and egress from the city. The cases that seem to have popped up in other countries relate to individuals that were infected in China and traveled out before those transportation barriers were put in place. That kind of work is an incredible logistical feat to try to essentially close down the movement of humans. And so there's a lot of work from the World Health Organization down to individual cities that are trying to do their best to contain this. One disclaimer just before you chime in. So I'm going to give my best to give a take on this, but you should definitely, if you want to know more information, go to vetted information sites like the World Health Organization or the CDC. Go to vetted places, because there's a lot of information on social media that may or may not be accurate depending on the source of information. So be really careful about where you go. Sorry, go ahead.
To the best of our knowledge, what are the people in these cities that are locked down doing with their lives right now?
We don't have very good information, because the press insight into those places is very limited. And that's both a combination of the fact that this is China and the fact that there wasn't a lot of people embedded in those cities to begin with that had ties to global outlets. So we don't know. We've gotten like kind of sporadic reports that people are essentially quarantined in their homes. So you can imagine the kind of shelter in place mentality that's going on. And we've heard snips of how people are really fighting over food and water and some basic supplies, and how the government's trying to respond to those needs while maintaining the integrity of the quarantine itself.
Yes.
So I think it's a very, very tense situation. Something that ranges probably between boredom, because you're just trapped at home for periods of time and for an indefinite period of time, to something that's just absolutely terrifying.
To survival.
Yeah. And so I would imagine, just given how what we understand about the transmission, which is happening person to person, generally through coughs and sneezes, that if I was in that city right now, I'd be just terrified of interacting with any humans.
Yeah. I mean, we have seen people use VPNs to get around and post videos on YouTube trying to explain the situation, but it's like in their houses, in their apartments, and you can't really get a sense of what it is in the streets right now. Yeah.
And this is such a weird situation in the sense that no one's like wandering around, walking around the city to give you sort of like the citywide view. So you're getting these really personal takes. Let's talk about the actual science, what, you know, and the gap. So the virus itself probably originated in this market, as I mentioned, but it's sort of secondary now. We've sort of crossed the threshold where we need to contain the outbreak, and they'll probably, in sort of, once it's sort of fully contained, they'll probably do a retrospective to try to track it back. So right now, the emphasis is full, almost entirely on containing the outbreak, characterizing the virus, and developing potential treatments to it. So a couple notes. So a number of scientific journals have all banded together to say any information on this will be immediately available to the public. There's a lot of sites that are doing something called preprints, so you can actually publish your data before it's peer-reviewed. They've actually characterized the virus already. So scientists have identified the virus, characterized it. Johnson & Johnson and a few other companies are actually working on a vaccine right now. So this kind of rapid development from essentially 8 weeks ago to having this virus appear in the first cases to us having characterized the virus and already working on treatments, we've never seen that kind of progress before in medical science. And this is in direct contrast to SARS, where it was almost 6 months before we identified the virus itself. So this is huge progress and like a note of optimism for the future. Two, you'll hear a lot about the transmission rate. And I think this is an important thing. You'll typically hear this referred to as a number called the R-naught number, which is the potential virus transmission rate. So R-naught for this virus right now, somewhere it's changing a lot because we're still kind of figuring out what the cases are. It's somewhere between like 2.5 and 3.3. So let's just call it 3. That means that if Jeremy had the virus, he has the potential of transmitting it to 3 other humans if he had regular contact with them.
Regular contact. So this is kind of like a fudging.
You already see the problems with this number, right? It shows you potential disease transmission. Right. So it's almost like if you're playing the board game Pandemic, it's like you're factoring in like if this card comes up, this is how it could spread to multiple cities.
Is it kind of a measure of how contagious it is?
Yes,
but it's like the most distilled one, like one number couldn't possibly, like you need to have a simple term for it for public awareness, but like just saying yellow alert, you know, orange alert is not,
so let me
context for that.
Let me contextualize it. So the R-naught number for measles is between 12 and 18. The R-naught number for the typical influenza virus is 3. So it doesn't really tell you. Or no, seasonal flu is like more like 1 to 2. R-naught number for SARS was 3. Ah. It doesn't tell you what the virus actual transmission will be. It's the potential transmission. And what it really doesn't account for is once we figure out that this is happening, all the systems we put into place to prevent that transmission.
And the systems today are very different than the systems last year, given forms of communication that we have now, like social media. And so I'm really curious because, like, you know, way back years ago, we visited a supercomputer facility at, where was it? It was Texas, I want to say. And they used those computers for modeling, like, propagation rates and how viruses can spread. And those models must be changing so frequently, at least you would hope, that this all feels so unpredictable.
It does. And the R-naught number is being used by a lot of mathematical models to predict what the current rate of diagnosis should be, like how many cases we should have based on the transmission rate we expected before some interventions took in place. And this is the actual like interesting use of the number is for a long time, especially last week, the number between what the potential diagnosed cases were versus the actual diagnosed cases was variant by off by a factor 4. Like we were, there was 500 cases, I think last week when we were reporting and
based on
there were some calculations, some papers that came out saying that we should have 2000 by now. So that's a factor of 4 difference that is scary because it points to, even if there aren't 2000 cases, it also points to like underlying, are we under, diagnosing this? Are there people that have this that aren't being reported? Is China not like being transparent?
Or are we potentially like controlling it better than we anticipated?
Yes, it could be that too. That's pretty unlikely from last week where they were looking at, you know, essentially before any interventions came into place, that number will probably go down. And we're already seeing the models and the number of diagnosed cases like come much more in alignment in just a week. I'll say there's a couple things we don't know. So what's important is how contagious, what's the likelihood of people to get sick, and what's the mortality rate. Right now, the mortality rate is staying pretty stable at about 1.3%. And so if that stays in this 1% to 2% region, that's actually very good. I mean, it's weird to say that, but that's a pretty low number. Mm-hmm. And so if they can sort of manage that and keep that pretty stable, we're in a good place. The idea of when you contract it to when you start displaying symptoms and when you're contagious during that is something we don't know at this point.
Right.
And that is a big, important number. So the big concern of this is if I contract the virus and I don't show any symptoms for a week, but I'm contagious during that time, it's a really big problem for potential transmission and spread of the disease. And so right now they're trying to hone in on what that number is, because we're dealing with only a population of 6,000. The numbers are happening real time. They're really trying to keep up with that. But I think that's what they're going to narrow in on. What is that? And then the mortality rate. Like, most people are exhibiting pneumonia-like illnesses. So what are the interventions they're going to make to try to continue to lower the mortality rate, but also up the identification of this? Right now they're using like infrared to see if you have a fever and stuff
in airports and such,
and typically that's already a little late.
Are the people who have died, are they being properly cared for beforehand?
We have no idea at this point. I mean, at least I don't. I haven't seen a lot of information about the 132 cases where they passed away, but as far as we can tell, they are hospitalized, they are being cared for, they have characterized why they're sick. So from that perspective, it seems like they're getting the right care given the situation. What was concerning last week is that 15 of the people that were infected when we talked about it last week were nurses and hospital workers that had caught it from people that were infected that came in. They've seemingly put in places protocols to prevent that.
Do outbreaks like this typically resolve, if they are resolved positively, through a vaccination discovery or through isolation and containment, and then letting kind of the time solve it?
I mean, this is one of those things where like there isn't enough sort of like historical, like this is what is going to work in this situation, because it's a complicated ethos. But my personal take is that it is the logistical work of isolating people, educating them and preventing the spread, that is the most effective here. It's not going to be the vaccine. It is going to be the kind of sense around how we prevent this from breaking out, isolating people, because if the virus has nowhere to go, that's how you essentially kill it off.
Yeah. It's not going to be Dustin Hoffman's outbreak.
Yeah. And then the vaccine becomes almost a preventative measure for future containment. But right now, it's really the isolating of the people, the characterization of the virus itself. I want to say I feel very optimistic at seeing this kind of response. I think even 10 years ago, we wouldn't have this rapid of a response and this coordinated response. There's lots of problems with the response, and you'll see dissection of all of the issues that arose during this. But from where I see a lot of progress and a lot of hope for the future if something else emerges on this vein. It's a serious issue, but not one that, at least here in the States and in other countries outside of China, I think you need to be worried about. I don't think there's a reason for you to be wearing, you know, masks in public if you're concerned about this coronavirus in countries away from China right now. It's not going to be an effective.
Why isn't it effective if it is transmitted from sneezing and coughing?
No, but I mean, the prevalence, there's 5 cases in the U.S. So it's not like the likelihood of 5 people out of 300 million, even if that number is 25 people, the likelihood that you're going to run into one of those people is so low. It's a math thing.
Right. Can we talk about herd immunity for just a moment?
Sure.
I don't know how to raise this question delicately, but like, is there if you were to contract this virus and fight it, if you're in that, you know, if you have that 99% chance of survival, is your immunity not stronger, if your immune system not stronger having engaged with this virus, and now you are more immune to it in the future and viruses like it? Is anybody talking about just over the years as we combat viruses with these types of strategies to isolate people and keep them away from the virus? Is there anybody talking about how that's affecting our gene pool and the lack of immunity that we will have to viruses going forward?
So to the best of my knowledge, and if I'm wrong about this, please call me out in the comments. I'm really open to feedback on this. Best of our knowledge, like, we don't understand what immunity looks like for this particular virus at this point. So it's way too early for us to really be commenting on it, because we don't know if this is a virus where the people that had it and it didn't really develop any sickness, or they had very mild sickness, if they're susceptible to it again in the future. We don't know any of that at this point. It's just way, way, way too early.
Okay. But even in the context of flu shots.
Yeah. What about?
The same thing. Like, there are people who think that you shouldn't get your flu shot because it, you know, it's counter to protecting the herd and the bigger picture.
Yeah, I mean, people are going to make personal choices around this. My personal choice around this is when I look at the data, when I look at the advice of a lot of experts in the field, is that the flu shot, while imperfect, because the strain of flu that might emerge may or may not be the one that the vaccine is actually going to best protect you against, gives you an enhanced protection around getting the flu. And especially if you're older or immunocompromised, where the flu is potentially going to kill you. And the flu kills a lot of people, like 100,000 people in this country alone. So it's not a joke. I'd rather give me any extra percentage points that I get with the risk of, with the downside. My personal take on the downside is that I feel a little crappy the next day after the flu shot.
I agree with you.
To me, it's worth the investment. Because of that. But for my parents, it's really worth the investment. Like, they're in their 80s. If they get sick, they're in much greater of danger from really being hospitalized from the flu.
I'm 100% with you. I get the flu shot, and I agree with you.
But this isn't really a herd immunity thing.
You don't think so?
Not with the flu.
Oh, well, it seems to me like there's a discussion there. And I think that we are probably augmenting our natural immune system with science. And we are, you know, across the board when it comes to medicine. And there's something, I think that's the right choice. I just think that it should be acknowledged that we're starting to do that. You know, it's an interesting discussion. That's all.
Yeah. Well, we'll try to stay up to date on this. But again, I will reinforce 2 points. Go to vetted sites for information. And I don't think you should be panicked about it.
Play Pandemic. Have fun.
I don't know. Pandemic, like, makes me want to rage quit a bunch of times.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you played it? Though.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Board game.
Yes.
Never
really
played
enjoyable.
It. There's another video game called Plague Incorporated.
Okay.
Or is that the name of the company? In any case, they, that's the game. It's a video game. It was the highest downloaded app on the App Store the past week.
Oh my goodness.
Both in China and in the U.S., because it simulates disease spreading.
People want to see that model.
They have, the company that makes it have come out with a press release saying, don't
take it seriously.
Don't simulate coronavirus with our app. It's not scientific.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm just putting that out there. A little PSA.
If you're going to watch Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh film that came out 10 years ago, like, it's entertainment.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's not. It's not a prescription for how to,
especially what happens in movie theaters. I'll just leave it there. Yeah, remember that too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh boy, that's very super reassuring, Jeremy.
We are trapped in this room. What are you doing to me?
Three people. There are only two people here. Do you hear me?
It's all good.
Okay. In pop culture news, there is a bunch of stuff to talk about. One is, this is heavily, heavily rumored. This is one of those stories that I think got, frankly, a little bit out of control on social media. But the report is that Disney Plus has put on hold the Obi-Wan series. That crew members and production folks were told to go home. We're going to rework the scripts before they continue. It's not a report that it's canceled, even though that's what a lot of the early social media fear was. But
I think the rumors were that leadership, executives at Lucas, I don't know how true this is at all, were super unhappy with the direction of the scripts.
Creative differences.
Yeah, there are rumors that there's been dismissals, but I think those are not substantiated as far as we can tell.
Did you guys not see what Ewan McGregor said about this?
What did he say?
He said everything's fine. It's just been postponed. Yeah. Everything's still on track. Yeah. He even said it probably won't affect the release date, that they've just postponed production into next year.
I think the pressure is put on a television show. First of all, there's a lot of pressure put on this television show. Probably way more than The Mandalorian, even though that was the first live action Star Wars show to debut on Disney Plus, because this is a beloved character where the story will affect the Star Wars canon. Now, the people that they hired to run the show, Deborah Chow, who worked on The Mandalorian. I mean, the work is out there. You can see how well received and how great those episodes are. So I think the sky's not falling. This is all natural part of production. And let's wait and see.
Maybe we shouldn't know about these things and like these shows.
Yes.
Until they're ready.
Until they've all been shot?
Yeah.
That's no fun.
I mean, unless there's like a full-on Deborah Chow has been fired and it's like a public thing, there's a press release about. I think this rumor mill potentially hurts the product on the other side, because now you have...
Now that's the story.
All of those people at Lucas, they aren't immune to seeing what the conversation is, and I think it adds pressure. It probably affects choices they're making. Mandalorian struck me as something that was immune to that because it was so under the radar in terms of like the writing process. All of it was done before we really heard anything about it.
This is a zero risk show. Also, yeah. It's going to be one season, presumably, because it's, you know, how are they? There's no way they're going to get Ewan McGregor to do multiple seasons to tell a story that, you know, that is bookended by the movies, right? This is a prequel story. So unlike The Mandalorian, they're not doing this with the hope for a season two. People are going to watch it regardless. It's going to be a killer app, or it's going to be killer content for Disney Plus. So even if it's not the perfect show, they're going to get 10 good episodes. These things are built on machine, and it's going to be a success, right? So they should just trust their instincts, let the screenwriters do their job, let the directors do their job, and put out a show and not let this kind of story affect it. And even if it's not well-received, big deal, it's not going to affect like the next Star Wars movie they do, right? It's not going to have any bearing on the performance, the box office receipts for a future Star Wars film, because that's going to be completely different.
Unless Obi-Wan comes out and he's like, I hated Luke and Leia. I hated those kids. Those kids ruined my life.
No one's going to remember. They could always Christmas special it. Rewrite it.
Lion King's out on Disney Plus now.
Oh, is live it? Action.
The quote unquote.
Yep.
Not Disney highest. Considers it live action, so it's not nominated for animated.
Highest grossing film. Disney film of all time.
Last year.
All time. Look it up.
Disney, but Marvel is a Disney
Avengers
film.
Avengers Endgame was owned by Marvel.
Well, that, you know.
You're drawing lines now, artificial lines.
Hey, maybe it is just animated.
I think you're talking about.
But then they said it's not animated.
This is, again, an artificial line that Disney's drawing. It is very successful, undoubtedly. Yeah. Jon Favreau did good work there. Yeah. Ghost in the Shell is coming out. There's going to be a Netflix show. And there's a trailer that's released.
Did you watch it yet?
I did not watch the trailer, but I have read that there is some debate among the Ghost in the Shell fans. What is it about the art style for this that's so controversial, potentially?
Well, I was going to ask you that very question, Norm.
I think it's because it's 3D CG. It is not... It's kind of like in the way... It almost looks like video game graphics.
It does look like that we're watching a cutscene, yeah, as opposed to something that has the manga roots to it. And... like we're watching a scene right now that is in like full daylight. It does occur as a video game. Wow, I am not into this.
Yeah,
at all.
Animation's expensive. Yeah, anime is very expensive, and they're banking on. And that's not to say you can't do a great CG rendered, 3D CG rendered animated show. I think isn't Star Wars Resistance that is technically 3D. But they cel shade it in a way to make it look like hand-drawn animation in some scenes.
I don't know anything about Ghost in the Shell. I think it was an anime film, right?
Like you haven't watched it?
Came out after Akira. Is that right?
I don't know the exact timeline.
I don't know anything about it.
You haven't watched it?
No.
It's a good watch.
Yeah.
It's like one of the classics.
Is it based
on... Have you seen Akira?
Yeah. Is it based on a comic book series?
It's based on a manga, yeah.
Yeah. That came out first, and then the movie. Mm-hmm. And then has there been any other film adaptations?
Well, the Scarlett Johansson thing.
Oh, right. Yeah. And was that wasn't terribly well received, or it must have been for them to be doing this?
This is, I think, not based on that. This is based on the original source material.
Right.
And it's hoping that the fans of the original source material will subscribe to Netflix to watch it. And I think there's going to be a good amount that will, because they just want to see continuation of the story. It is unfortunate that's not done in the traditional style, but that style is super expensive. And that's not to say Netflix doesn't have the cash to spend it, but it's also incredibly time consuming, and there's not a ton of studios that can do
the traditional style being just
hand-drawn.
Drawn
exactly.
Akira, like the original movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You think that's harder to do than incorporating 3D models?
Yes. Yeah. To do in a TV series, to create, to do in however many hours of content you want to do, and not just a 90-minute or two hours.
Because I was a big fan of the new Voltron series.
And that was all 3D. That was drawn.
That was drawn.
That was drawn.
It was a mix.
But the drawn parts... And you guys have to correct me if I'm wrong, but and if you compare it to like 90s and 80s anime, the attention to detail and the amount of animation that's drawn was way overboard. It's like completely impractical. It's one of the reasons fans love it, you know, love films like Akira, is because there's so much painstaking work, because they had one chance to get one scene right. And so they threw hours and hours and hours into every single frame. That's not practical for a Netflix television show.
I see what you're saying. This really is CG. This is
straight up.
Looks like a video game.
Looks like a video game cutscene. Or not even a cutscene. It just looks like, you know rendered on a high-end
Yeah, but you console. Say that these days, like video games.
They look fantastic.
AAA look better than this.
They do. It's like watching Metal Gear.
Yep.
A Metal Gear cutscene. Netflix and Apple apparently are both vying for the MGM back catalog. Now, I think it would make sense for Netflix to spend a bunch of money and get the back catalog. There's an expectation there. On the Apple side, the reason I want to bring up the story is that does Apple need a back catalog for Apple TV Plus?
Well, what kind of stuff is in the MGM catalog?
They got James Bond.
Okay.
They do have some of the things they produce. I think Handmaid's Tale is part of that.
Oh, that's a good show.
But that's a Hulu show, so I don't know exactly how that syndication would work. But there are a bunch of, you know, anything you've seen, the Roaring Lion.
It isn't like some sort of, like, there isn't this blockbuster show. It's not like a Game of Thrones or like something like that.
It's a back catalog play.
VH1's Love and Hip Hop.
Oh, yeah, one of the classic shows of our generation.
But the question is, does Apple... Maybe it's a mistake, right? Maybe.
Why? If you're Apple, aren't you still in the proving ground with the original content? Why are you back cataloging?
That's 100% what they started with. But maybe they've looked at the numbers and the retention numbers, and maybe they want to pivot. because you can spend $1 billion on content. If people aren't watching it because there's so much new content, then you got to go back to the well and license content. It's why there have been such big deals done for shows like The Office and Friends on other streaming services. And I think it would be, sad. I think it would be a mistake for Apple to rely on back catalog to bolster their numbers, even if that's what the metrics show, what people and viewers want, because I think it's a missed opportunity to develop original content further and really position themselves more as an HBO than a Netflix.
Guys, let me just tell you, I don't think anybody at Apple 2 months into the service is looking at the numbers and saying, hey, everybody, this isn't working out out of this Apple TV Plus deal. I just don't know. This is a 5-year like launch. I guarantee you
it's a hobby.
They have a plan that's going to take them through like the next few iPhones and the next services.
It's a hobby within a hobby.
They know they don't have the numbers this year. That's why they gave it away to everybody who bought a new device. It's a long-term plan. That this has always been in the cards. They know they need some extra fodder on the service.
I don't buy that.
I don't buy that either. I think the shareholders would expect more, and I think they're going to look at stock price and look at their services division, and if they're not getting those dollars, then it's also a missed opportunity. Then those dollars are going elsewhere, essentially.
We'll know in a few months when they, what's it called? What's the
WWDC?
Mac World? Yeah. We'll know because... Even though that's not, you know, where they would naturally talk about Apple TV, if it's not there at all, that's going to be a bad sign for the platform. Yeah.
The Steve Carell show did very well at the awards, I think.
Morning show?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, an important part of, you know, starting to get people interested in, and it's definitely the play that Amazon did and Hulu did, and getting a lot of a small number of their original shows to get nominated and then get people interested in things like Handmaid's Tale and Marvelous Miss Maisel. But Apple, I think it's a 2-year runway at most, and at that point, they can't continue spending hundreds of millions of dollars on shows. I mean, they could. Technically, they could do anything they want. They have a $200 billion cash reserve. They can spend however they want, but they're investors are going to want to see that return. And I could see them exiting the premium subscription TV play sooner than we think.
No, dude. There's just the percentage of returns they make on this service, the investors are not looking at that.
They are looking at it because they want to see the projection, the ramp up. Mm-hmm. And if they can't see the hockey stick for this as a pillar of their services department, then that doesn't bode well for their future as a services company, at least in the content side. I mean, they have iCloud, and that's going to get them a ton of money. Mm-hmm. They have music, which is doing all right, and they have Arcade, which again, this falls in the same bucket as Arcade, and that strong launch potentially. But I don't know what the retention is going to be. They might have put too much at this point. Fall into the Apple News category, where you know they're asking too many people. They're asking for people, even though there's this massive user base, to subscribe to too much all at once without a competitive advantage.
I could be wrong. I don't think Apple reports any earnings based on this one service. I think
they don't.
They lump it all together. So it's sort of left to your imagination.
Yeah. And I can only imagine this not doing so well.
But again, I think they don't expect it to yet.
Yeah. Couple movies. They're coming out that I want to mention that I'm excited about. One is Denis Villeneuve's Dune. And this past week, we got the very, very first look at the logo, although the copyright holders are already trying to remove the logo from fan accounts.
I approve.
Yes.
So how is that possible? I like it.
It's so good. So good. So a bunch of it's DMCA takedowns. Take it down. Let's not get a DMCA takedown on this podcast. But it's super easy to find. Just search Dune logo. I think it was it was brought up at an event where what was it? Warner France had some.
Oh, come on. It's dumb. People can't share the logo. It's dumb.
This is PR.
They love it. They love that people are fighting to see this logo.
probably also. Yeah. So it was brought up at a presentation, and it's coming out at the end of this year, December 23rd.
Maybe it's not the real one. Maybe that was
no, it. No. This was at an official event, revealed at an event in France. The movie producers put it up behind the big screen, and what you saw was like the perspective corrected version, and it looks like you see the planet.
Cool.
The desert planet, but the logo, you know what it evokes? It evokes the Alien logo. Do you remember when Alien... the title sequence in the original Ridley Scott Alien, and it was solitary lines that slowly faded in, and then the angles, and then it's an alien. That's one of the best opening sequences. It's so creepy. It's so atmospheric. And the fact that the letters, the four letters of Dune are all using the same shape, but just turned.
Kind of says dunk, but it's all good.
Well, there's the E. You have the line for the E is a star.
Oh.
And it's lens flare that gives you the E.
Oh, clever.
The middle line of the E.
Nice work.
It's a beautiful logo. Yeah. Very excited for this film. How about Fast 9, guys?
They're making it? I had no idea.
It's coming out this year. The first full trailer is going to come out tomorrow.
You can't stop Fast and Furious. You can only hope to contain it.
It's the Fast Saga now, they're calling it.
Do we get Jason Statham?
I don't think so. I think that the spinoff, I don't think the spinoff folks, The Rock and Jason Statham, are part of this one.
Oh, no.
So no Hobbs or no Shaw?
I don't think you get it. Yeah, I think it's going to be back to the core family of
Dominic.
Dom and Michelle Rodriguez and their kid now. Yeah. I did hear a rumor, though, and this 100%. I know we kind of bashed rumors earlier, but this is something I'm actually hoping would happen. So, you know, the Bad Boys 3 was in theaters.
Yeah, people like it.
And it's apparently really good. It turned out that if you have a Bad Boys film that's not directed by Michael Bay, it could be pretty good. It's doing well. It made a ton of money. They already have already greenlit Bad Boys 4.
Oh, my.
But there is a wish. It's a glimmer in a fan's eye that Bad Boys and the Fast and Furious series will converge, and it'll turn out that it's in the same universe, and you're going to get a Dominic Toretto and Will Smith crossover.
Fast Boys Forever.
What you going to do?
That would be incredible. I'm all for this. Of course, there are two different studios. I think one's Universal on the Fast series, and Bad Boys, I want to say, is Sony. But if they that would be an Avengers-level
I'm
meeting.
Into this if the the credit stinger is Jackie Chan and Chris Tucker.
Are they opposing each other? Like, are the cops out to get the Fast and Furious team?
100%.
Okay, I like it.
100%.
That sounds good. But yeah, who do you focus on? Like, is it really just like split?
Yeah, it's two parallel storylines. Just give me that end credit sequence where you have Will Smith walking in. Martin Lawrence walking in, getting too old for this, still, and looking for Dom.
I like it.
Yeah.
And I've never even seen Fast and Furious.
But Bad Boys.
But now I want to see
but
that.
But now you want to see. You know, the Men in Black 21 Jump Street sequel crossover died, so this could happen. Do you remember this?
That was not a thing.
It was 100% a thing. You know, 21 Jump Street, which Phil Lord, Chris Miller did, awesome film, great rebooting of a franchise. And
it,
then they did
it is?
Oh, yeah, it's so good.
Did they do that before Lego Movie?
They did.
Wow.
And then they also came back and did 22 Jump Street, which was a total riff on sequels. And that was also fantastic. And Sony had this great idea to do a Men in Black 22 Jump Street crossover as a riff on crossovers and shared universes. And it would be, you know, Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill joining the Men in Black.
This is the future.
I thought it was a fantastic idea.
Yep.
I don't think it sullies the Men in Black movie at all.
Nope.
Because those are pure comedies anyway, and they're ridiculous. But it was that idea was nixed because it came out in the Sony hack.
Ah.
And so I think they came. It was an actual plan.
That leaked.
And it was, at least the discussions about it were revealed in the Sony hack. I don't know how far they actually got along.
Right.
But then ended up, of course, not happening. But I can only dream. And I'm going to dream of a Fast Saga, Bad Boys crossover.
Yes.
The FCU. Yeah, you decide what that F means.
The FCU. K. You guys like The Big Lebowski?
Yeah, very much.
You know, there's a spinoff coming out.
Is it about Jesus?
It's about Jesus.
That's been in talks for decades.
There's a movie poster. It's already been filmed.
It's happening?
I didn't know this was happening at all. I thought this was like, it looked like a Photoshop poster, but it's John Turturro, Bobby Cannavale, Audrey Tautou. Oh my goodness. Amelie's in this?
Amelie.
Susan Sarandon, John Hamm, and Christopher Walken, and Pete Davidson, who's on the movie poster.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Bring it.
Hey, I'm all for more bowling movies.
Yeah. I don't think the Coen brothers are involved in this.
What?
At least I don't think it's not their film.
That doesn't bode well. Okay.
Who's directing this? IMDb that.
I'll work on that.
But it's coming out on March 20th. That's soon.
Well, that can't be good.
I think it's going to be a low-key release for fan service.
Jesus Rolls.
Director is John Turturro.
Oh, what? Well, that's interesting.
Okay. All right.
I'm back on board.
One of the Ethan Coen
wrote it
is one of the author credits, but it seems like they gave him the author or writer credit because he created the characters.
Yeah. All right. John Turturro directing. Okay. I'm in.
Isn't that funny? You got a character who maybe had 10 minutes of screen time in a film.
Hey, if you create a comic book character and they're used in a film, get the credit.
No, I'm not talking about the credit. I'm talking about the movie. Like they made a whole spin-off movie. Right. Like that character was so successful.
But beloved in pop culture.
So beloved. Everybody loves the Jesus.
I mean, how many people have licked bowling balls
because
of that one character? He's probably
causing talk
a
about
lot of diseases.
Dangerous public health situation. Do not lick bowling balls.
Yeah.
That's great.
Mm. Last bit of movie news. Next week, filming in San Francisco, Matrix 4.
Oh, Matrix 4.
Well, now that's not confirmed. It's confirmed that there's going to be low-flying helicopters and streets shut down for days on end and like all hours of the night.
It's Matrix 4.
But it appears it might be Matrix
4. I think that's what...
Keanu has been spotted in Alameda already.
Already?
In an ice cream store.
Well, sad that's Keanu? Just a thing Happy Keanu Connor? Reeves would do.
No, that's how he...
Bearded? No bearded?
When he's sad, he goes to the ice cream store to
cheer himself. Do you think he'll have long hair in this one?
Oh, let's talk about the big questions. That's a good one. I have no idea.
He did shave the images of him for Bill and Ted. He has no beard. And he's been known to have the long hair and the beard for John Wick.
Mm-hmm.
Neo had neither.
What if he's a broken down Neo?
Neo's dead.
He'll be whatever is most easily CG'd. That's what they always did with the Matrix films. That's why they wore sunglasses and trench coats, because you can recreate that much
easier. You don't
need
to show eyes.
Exactly. No Uncanny Valley.
Wow. This is why you should go to kids trying to dress up as Neo in the 90s. This fashion statement is for special effects. It's not because they like leather trench coats. It's because it was easy to CG.
That's cool. I mean, that must have cost a fortune to shoot in San Francisco, I would think. It doesn't happen that often you get these... low flying helicopters and streets shut down.
Mm-hmm. I think that does it for pop culture news.
Can I buzz market something?
I'm going to say no for reasons I'll tell you after the podcast.
Awesome. Oh, that I'm really excited about that.
And before we move on to our next segment, I want to let you know that this episode of This Is Only a Test is made possible with support from Capital One's Eno. Capital One knows life doesn't alert you about your credit card. That's why they created Eno, the Capital One assistant that catches things that might look wrong with your credit card, like overtipping, duplicate charges, or potential fraud, then sends an alert to your phone and helps you fix it. It's another way Capital One is watching out for your money when you're not. Capital One, what's in your wallet? See CapitalOne.com for details. You know, a couple days ago, Apple released their earnings report for the first quarter of 2020, which includes the past holiday season.
Yeah.
And they blew away a lot of their, the expectations and even their own guidance. Of course, they don't release specific numbers of sales units for a lot of specific devices. They group a lot of them together, such as their wearables. You don't know how many actual Apple Watches they sold. They talk about Apple Watches plus AirPods plus other wearables like all together. But the assumption is AirPods are doing quite well. But something that's interesting is that wearables segment of their product line has already surpassed, it's on the rise and surpassed not only the Mac segment, number of, you know, the amount of dollars they sold selling Macs, but also, and definitely units because Macs sell for a lot higher, but also iPads. And iPads is what I want to talk about this week because this past week was the 10th anniversary of the announcement of the iPad. And I want to go take a trip down memory lane and talk about what life was like for those of you out there who may not remember or do remember pre-iPad and post-iPad.
Did you both have an iPad 1?
Oh, yeah.
You? No.
So the iPad came out at an interesting time for Tested specifically because it was announced in January before Tested was started up. And this is our 10-year anniversary. And it was released in March right after we started. It's one of the first things we covered on Tested was the release of the iPad. Will went to buy one when we were still had an office in Sausalito. I think he went to an Apple store early in the morning, picked one up, and we did a kind of a first look overview of the iPad as I want to even say live stream back at the old Sausalito office. Definitely recorded it and put it out there. And then I took it to, it came out on the day of WonderCon when it was in San Francisco because I brought the iPad to WonderCon. And then that following day, it was right before South by Southwest, I want to say, we took it apart and we did a disassembly.
You took apart an iPad?
Yeah. It was one of the very first videos in my living room before we even had a full set. We used my living room and took apart an iPad.
Are any of those videos online today?
I think they're on YouTube.
They're on the YouTube channel.
I want to say if you search iPad. Right. And also it's Chloe. Oh, Chloe Bannon. Licks an iPad was our first viral video.
I remember that. That was a big deal.
It was on Chinese media. It was on all over the world. People took clips of Will's dog, Chloe.
Wasn't it like playing with a fake fish tank or something?
She was barking at it. A dog barks at an iPad or plays with an iPad.
But what was running on the iPad?
I have no idea.
I'm going to say fish tank.
Maybe it was a fish tank. Okay. Will filmed it with his phone.
Yep.
And we uploaded it. This is like early,
if
early
only there
YouTube
is a way to find out.
Days. Can we put this on? Oh, there it goes. There's a piano. Oh,
it's not a fish tank. It's a piano.
Oh, it's Chloe. Yeah. iPad means a lot. Meant a lot to Tested. Maybe there was a fish tank. Oh, she's playing with the iPad.
That's a lily pad. I'm going to get points for lily pad.
You're going to get lily pad? Okay. All right. So the year is 2010. And iPhone's been out for 3 years. App Store at this point has been out. So we have the killer app for mobile devices. And iPhone's already doing very well. But the rumors are building that Apple's going to announce a tablet, a slate. Now, this comes off the heels of CES, where Microsoft has announced Windows 7. And Windows 7 is a huge success for Microsoft. They're feeling pretty good already. Do you remember the PC landscape in 2010? Windows 7 is out. It was after the debacle that was...
I know Windows 7 was great because people are still running it and Microsoft can't get them off it.
Well, they're trying to with the free upgrades to Windows 10.
Well, that's over, but yeah.
But it was after, you know, Windows ME, people were running Windows 2000 as the default Windows, and then Windows 7 came out. It was super smooth, super fast, had a lot of great features before, of course, the reactionary release that was Windows 8. Steven Sinofsky was head of the Windows group then. But also... PCs were selling really well. People were building PCs. iPhones were becoming a thing. Smartphones, you know, were really dominated by BlackBerry.
Right.
And then Apple as an emerging contender.
The iPhone was only 3 years old at the time.
Only, right? 3G was out. Apple 3G was out, right, for iPhone. iPhone even, it was all done with Samsung chips back then, right?
Okay.
And netbooks were the other thing that were big.
What is a netbook?
Oh my God, Kishore is playing a video of Will and I taking apart the
iPhone. Is it like a dumb laptop?
It's a cheap laptop.
Yeah.
A netbook back in 2010 was a whole segment that sold, I want to say, 40 or 50 million units.
Wow.
And all the PC OEMs were putting these small form factor, affordable laptops together that people would buy as maybe their first laptop because they could buy one for $400.
But it was for browsing the web.
It was for browsing the web and email.
Yeah.
And really, the reason they existed, not only for the price point, was a way for Intel to make use of their Atom processors. Mm. Microsoft and Intel said, we want to put Windows, sell Windows, get people using Windows. And Atom and Intel had these low-power Atom processors that weren't going to be great for smartphones, and so they put them in laptops. And the expectation wasn't that these would be able to run, you know, games, have discrete graphics, or be great for anything, any type of productivity that we think of today, photo editing, video editing. It was media browsing.
So what's the context here? Are you saying that people expected the iPad to be a touchscreen version of that?
Yes. That people expected that Apple was going to fill a segment between iPhone and Mac,
yeah,
and do something that was either going to compete with netbooks or be the touchscreen Mac. I think a lot of people wanted the touchscreen Mac.
They're Isn't actually, that how it started? It, didn't it start as like an idea to Jobs around a touchscreen MacBook?
The history is where the iPad was in development before the iPhone. And they shelved iPad development because they had reason, you know, the iPhone, the deal with the carriers gave them a reason to create a whole new type of product to, you know, of course, as we know, revolutionize smartphones and cellular devices. But they had said on earnings calls, they would never do a netbook because the netbook user experience wasn't great.
Still isn't.
And that's why that whole category died. You're not going to play this whole video the entire time.
Right? I like seeing young Norm and young Will.
Oh my goodness.
Kids.
Yeah, children back then. Still children today with kids of our own. I think if you Google what the fan images, the fan expectations of the iPad were before we even knew it was going to be called the iPad, a lot of people had thought it would maybe be called, you know, like a slate, iSlate. They were essentially Mac OS on a tablet form factor. You had the dock. It looked like there might have been a stylus. A lot of people expected that. A lot of people expected ports, USB ports. The dream iPad before Apple actually announced the iPad was like a $1,000 to $1,500 device that would give you touchscreen capability on Mac OS. Multitasking, Windows side by side. If you have a 10-inch display.
You can finally do that today.
Not really.
No, the iPad has the mode where it becomes a screen on your Mac.
Oh yeah. But the multitask, you don't actually have Windows natively in iOS. And of course, the pricing was the big thing. So there were a couple of surprises when they did the keynote. You should watch the Steve Jobs keynote for iPad.
I remember it was one of his last. It was.
And they had that design within reach like couch that all the presenters sat in. You know, whether it was Phil Schiller or Scott Forstall, and their whole thing was, yeah, they said they were going to address this category that was going to be between iPhone and between Mac. That would be great for photos and ebooks and media and internet browsing. And they said, well, why didn't we make a netbook? Well, because the netbook's a garbage experience. Instead, we've made the iPad, and shocker, boom, $500.
Yeah, that's actually competitive by today's standards. I mean, that at the time, you would have expected more.
You 100% expected more because the iPhone, remember, launched at higher than $500.
Yep.
And so the people didn't expect that you could get something with a bigger screen, which they associated with being a more premium product for cheaper. And of course, we're talking about a $500 model, Wi-Fi model, not cellular. But they got the cellular built in if you wanted to pay more because it was based on the same architecture as the iPhone, and it was a big iPhone screen. People knocked it for that, remember? It's a big iPhone. But didn't realize that the big iPhone was what people wanted, a lot of people, to use in their homes.
Well, it brilliantly minimized the compatibility issues. So you could make one app and it would run on both.
It was such a bad experience. It still is a bad experience to
this
day. Have you ever tried Instagram on an iPad?
But that gave them a library and like something they don't have on Apple TV Plus.
Right, 140,000 apps at that time on iPhone and 3 billion app downloads immediately had a back catalog. But of course, they encouraged people to, at WWDC, develop their own iPad apps. They launched a whole suite of their own. Remember their own iPad apps they developed in-house that they sold at $10 a piece for word processing, for PowerPoint presentation, you know, not for presentations, for slides. Even GarageBand. These are big
things. Was GarageBand first year?
Yeah, I want to say it was.
Because, yeah. Man, I swear, like, as someone who's tinkered in music, I think if it was just a GarageBand device, it would have been worth $500.
That's one of the things that a lot of people looking back 10 years have said was a direction the iPad missed out on internally at Apple, that became too much of a games and consumption device, and that what Steve Jobs had pushed for, you know, the multi-touch model being any interface and any amount of and all sorts of productivity, like Apple had not pushed for that. Like even things like iMovie editing that they put out on iPad and iPhone are not highly integrated and highly used. So iPad, 10 years. You guys bought one, right?
No, I never had an iPad.
Really? Yeah.
I never had the original iPad. I had an iPad 2.
iPad 2 was big because of the slim design. You know, one of the things that people also may not remember is I think there was a lot of false advertising in the how slim the iPad was. If you look at a first gen iPad, not only are the bezels massive, which understandably, for design and need, but it was pretty thick. It had an edge to it, a silvered edge, and then behind that edge, it was pretty bulbous in the back.
Yeah. Lots of room for improvement.
And when they showed photos of it, they would only show that silver edge, the hard edge in the side, and hide the bulbous back of it. And I thought that was misleading. And it's not even until like today that you have an iPad that has like the iPad Pro is like the perfect iPad they wish they made 10 years ago, because it is really that thin and that light and has, you know, very thin bezels. And of course now has the pencil support. What was your favorite iPad? What do you think was the most important
that's
one?
My favorite of it.
Well, I mean, as someone who follows Apple products.
I only own one, so I'm not good for this conversation.
Mini was such a big deal.
I mean, I still only use a Mini, but it's a few years old. I don't know. I feel like I don't think that of the iPad as being something that deserves this kind of like reverence.
You don't think so?
No, I don't. I mean, I think it's a fine device. I think it's fine. It never did become like a laptop replacement for anybody I know, except my 10-year-old daughter, who never had a laptop. But still, you know, it's just not quite there yet. It is very much a device that I can grab and read the web before I fall asleep to. And if I didn't have the iPad in my life,
you'd be fine with the iPhone.
I'd be okay.
Yeah, yeah. And the iPhones, of course, got bigger. And so you have plenty big enough screen on your iPhone if you just want to do that content.
That said, it is totally futuristic from like a nostalgia standpoint. Like it is a Jetsons device.
It's the Star Trek pad.
It's the Star Trek pad. I'm glad it exists. And I think that touchscreen flat devices are going to be an interesting thing to track. Absolutely.
Yeah. When also now with stylus support. Either multi-finger touch or stylus support.
Yes. What was your favorite iPad?
The first one with the Retina screen.
Yeah, that's true.
That was, once they doubled that resolution, that was such a big deal.
After four?
Three.
Three.
Yeah. And also the iPad mini with the Retina screen. Mm-hmm. That was a massive deal.
I bought it day one.
Same resolution as the full-size one. And at that point, they were charging, the iPad mini was cheaper. That was maybe one of the big pricing mistakes on Apple's part. That they didn't.
Well, they undersold it. Like when it was at events, they're like, "Oh, we also have the iPad Mini with the same resolution." Right. That's it, everybody.
Right. You know, yeah. And I think they realize now smaller is something they can sell at a premium. The sweet spot.
Maybe.
And because it's more difficult to get cram all that stuff into a smaller screen and have it be just reliable. And that Mini, that's why it still endures today. And they updated it last year with all the guts. Also, the iPad was the first debut of the A-series processors. Hmm. I remember before iPad came out, we had speculated what chip were they going to use, x86 or ARM. And if they were going to use an ARM, I knew people were so convinced that it was going to use like a NVIDIA Tegra. Because Tegra was shown at CES earlier last year. And if they're using these Samsung phone chips for the iPhone, the NVIDIA stuff is super fast. Maybe they'll partner, and you had NVIDIA GPUs inside MacBooks. Maybe they'll use an NVIDIA chip for the iPad.
So it was the first Apple device with their own chip, is what you're saying?
No, I think there's a misconception there, because I think even with the first three iPhones, the Samsung manufacturer chip was highly influenced by Apple engineering. They just didn't call it A series chips. I think the iPad was the first one where they were proud enough to say, you know, even though it was still they didn't own the fabs yet, right? It was still manufactured under contract by Samsung. It was their design. They licensed from ARM, and they called it the A4 chip, which of course made its way into the iPhone 4, huge iPhone later that year. 2010 was a massive year for Apple. Debut of iPad and iPhone 4.
Do you think we'll see an interesting iPad this year in order to celebrate?
No.
Okay.
No. I think we're going to see some of the features of the iPad Pro make its way down to the iPad. And the three camera system on the iPhone make its way to the iPad.
Really?
I think so.
Okay.
Especially for AR capability. You want that ultra-wide camera and doing some depth mapping and room mapping. All right. Did you hear about Jeff Bezos' iPhone?
Unfortunately.
So there are a lot of reports about this, of course, about the alleged hacking of Jeff Bezos' iPhone X through a WhatsApp message. A video is apparently what's been revealed. The most interesting thing was that the malicious part of that message apparently was 140K.
Mm-hmm. That's nothing.
That's nothing for today's media standards and file standards, but that allowed some code to then tap into basic iPhone features to then upload data and use Safari web browsing and use mail apps to then send things that he wasn't aware of.
So I listened to the New York Times Daily episode on this hacking, and what's insane about this is what alerted him to the problem. So they actually looked at the data and saw that the outbound data usage from the phone had spiked in the couple days after this. But
Bezos, magnitude.
Yeah, yeah. So Bezos reportedly had a conversation in and around his phone and about Saudi Arabia, and then got a follow-up text from MBS regarding that conversation, who was not in that conversation. So
wait, they weren't already acquaintances sharing just informal chats with each other?
So they were talking. I mean, it's not unusual they would be talking. Like Amazon trying to open that market totally makes sense. But the idea that Bezos was having a totally independent conversation was essentially being eavesdropped, and then gets a message about it from MBS is what alerted him that something was going on with his phone. So, like, we wouldn't actually know about this unless that weird text had happened, alerting him that something weird was going on.
So that wasn't the hack text either.
No. This is after the hack has already occurred.
Yeah, and we're not even sure if he opened the video that the hack text, and it was contained within the WhatsApp.
But he did. He was vulnerable to a phishing scheme, right? I guess that's what you call it, a Trojan horse, where he was sent a text message on WhatsApp from the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia with a link that he clicked.
Yeah.
He shouldn't have clicked it. Like, we all know, don't click those links. But I guess if it's from somebody that you know,
then you trust,
then you might.
Haha, watch this video.
Yeah.
Super scary stuff. Yeah. A little more iPhone news. Hey, the thing they announced with the iPhone 11, multi-camera recording, finally is a thing you can do now. There's a new app from Filmic called Double Take, and it's on the iPhone 11 Pro. Actually, it should work with anyone with the, not even last year's iPhone, XS and the 11. And it allows you to record simultaneously, picture in picture, from the front-facing camera and the rear camera.
How is this new? I thought they demonstrated this.
They demoed it, but it hadn't been released yet.
Oh, so it's out now.
Finally out. It's called Double Take. They said they're looking into getting this functionality on Android phones, but with the fracturing of the Android ecosystem, it may be tough for them to figure that out.
You okay with that?
Okay. Yeah. Uses your microphone, so you can do things like, you know, interviews and see yourself. I don't know exactly if it's picture, like split screen, if it's burned into it old, like you, if you burn into the picture in picture, or if there's an option to save two files and have your perspective and also the subject's perspective at once, then you can sync it after the fact, which would be more useful for video editors.
I thought that's what it was.
Yeah. Mm. Right now it's like this embedded side by side split screen. Image. What else we got here in technology news? Something that is making its overway to Android, you're getting an AirDrop like feature soon. It's been demoed.
Yeah, we saw a video demo. This isn't public fully public yet. And it showed phone to phone sharing, essentially in a very similar way that AirDrop works. You know, a message pops up that you can transfer these files. There's some sort of authentication across. Proximity is the key to the transfer. It seemed to be moving pretty fast. The downside to this is, so I use AirDrop a lot with my MacBook, but that's the thing, is like I'm using it from two different device types, like a phone to the computer or a computer to, you know, to something else. I think what is limiting here is that this is phone to phone at this point, because that's what's in the ecosystem. So they're going to have to cross device type to really make this
Chromebook
useful
to Android.
Yeah. Chromebook. No one stores anything on a Chromebook. So like, what's the point? So the ecosystem isn't set up well for this. This is the feature I'm most envious of that iPhone users have.
I mean,
so I'm excited to see it here.
Do you remember how they made the promise that FaceTime would be an open standard and they would allow other hardware makers to tap into FaceTime?
I'd forgotten that.
Never happened. You know, I think they learned their lesson and realized what a competitive advantage it actually was to have FaceTime be locked into the Mac and iPhone ecosystems. And that's absolutely the case with AirDrop. There's no way. I mean, the dream would be, in a perfect world, be able to AirDrop to Windows devices and Android devices. Because right now, the ways to get media, increasingly high resolution and high bitrate media off Apple devices, off iPhone specifically, onto computers, and onto other platform computers, it's so difficult. I hate it. You know, you're filming, you have the phone that's with you at all times, and you're filming, you know, 4K, 60 FPS video, and it looks good on your phone. I want to get that into Premiere on a Windows PC. You have very few options. You can, and most of the options that you have end up compressing the video file.
I helped my son with a video project recently for school, and I uploaded all of the things that we shot in 4K to Google Drive.
Yep.
And it recompressed everything.
Yep. Terrible. Terrible. If you try to send it as SMS, huge compression.
Oh, God, no. You're limited by length, I think, if you try that.
If you try to iCloud and download from iCloud, huge, huge compression.
And I was on a PC, so I couldn't AirDrop it very easily.
Yep. Like the best way right now is AirDropping to someone with a Mac and then having them drag that into Dropbox.
So AirDrop is the raw file?
In some cases. In some cases, when you see it processing, they're compressing.
So how do you definitely get the raw file?
You have to plug it in with a physical cable and hope that connection doesn't fail as you're dragging a file, which happens all the time.
But all the files are cryptically named. How do you know which
I literally have to actually drag it into a preview. Or know the timestamp.
This is horrible.
It's horrible. And the file structures are completely obtuse.
Yeah. You're
randomly picking like these folders and trying to find the video file and then dragging it off. It's garbage.
Yep.
I hate it.
Can I introduce some breaking news?
Yeah.
MoviePass filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy finally today. And it came out that they likely owe $1.2 million to about 12,000 subscribers, which is about $100 each. And based on the filing, it's looking pretty unlikely that any of those subscribers are going to see any of that money.
All right.
RIP, and thank goodness.
Thank goodness. I'm so bummed for people who didn't cancel and get some of their money back earlier. Yeah. Too good to be true.
Well, hopefully they made it worth it.
Oh, they make the most out of it. Right.
I mean, at the time, hopefully they really took advantage of that service, which was clearly never meant to last.
Never. And also, it is...
You mean the scam service? Yeah, never? Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
There have been plenty of warnings. You know, it was written on the wall. If you did not cancel and you did make use of it, be happy that you got to make use of it. It's not worth fighting for, you know, that portion of that $100 or whatever it was, if you already got your $100 worth of movies, or you felt like you did. And last bit of story, hey, YouTube signed an exclusive streaming deal for esports. This is becoming a bigger and bigger thing. There's a story, was it on, I forget which site it was, it might have been Wall Street Journal, about all the different live streaming sites signing up streamers, stealing them from Twitch. And it gave the first kind of, first account of how much money Ninja got paid. And I think when Ninja signed with Mixer, the rumor was he made $50 million. And it sounds like someone with knowledge of the deal who works with Ninja or is a partner somehow. So it was about $20 to $30 million. But that really opened the floodgates for companies like Facebook, YouTube, Google, YouTube, and Microsoft with Mixer to start putting out these offers and taking streamers off of Twitch. And many of them have signed up. And you have a kid who watches. Jeremy?
Both of my kids watch stuff. I don't know. Not game streams so much. My daughter just taught me about this guy named Mr. Beast. Do you know about Mr. Beast?
Oh, Mr. Beast, I know.
I don't know Mr. Beast.
Yeah, it's just another YouTuber who happens to have, like, who's loaded mm-hmm. and gives money to random people to do silly things.
He worked on Team Trees with all the YouTubers.
There's that. But, you know, he'll also pay you, like, $15,000 if you can be the last one out of the pool. And you stay in the pool for 15 hours and you're the last one out and you get $15,000.
I don't like that. I'm not a fan of this. A lady died holding her pee to win a Wii.
Oh,
on
no,
a radio station.
No, that's horrible. That's horrible.
And this sounds like it could be horrible.
Yeah.
Anyway.
None of it's good. It's not bum fights, but it's not good.
That's a really, really low bar.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I did notice at Target, you can buy a Ninja wig if you want one and you want to start your streaming career and you want to leg up. Can buy a Ninja wig. It's probably really affordable too, like a real small investment.
Yeah, you wait a couple weeks, it'll be on clearance too. Don't worry about it.
The Party City doesn't have one. Wow. I mean, it's a whole thing. And aside from the streamers themselves, it's also the rights to competitive the games.
There's so many people watching these streams. Like, there's D&D streams with like 50,000 concurrent users. There's
what do you mean D&D?
Like Dungeons people watching Dungeons and Dragons streams with 50,000
people playing pen and paper board games.
Yes. Like some of the esports, like the big tournaments, you're seeing like 100K live viewers. These are huge numbers. We haven't seen it translate away from like desktop viewing platforms like Twitch or YouTube to like traditional things like ESPN. ESPN's tried to cover esports, and I don't think the ratings have been great. So, but I think we're going to see this now. There's so much money there just sitting there. Like, think about what the advertisements look like for a live audience when everyone is moving away from live on every other platform.
Yeah.
I'm not excited that it's Call of Duty for this YouTube one. Well, Call of Duty is not my favorite to watch on.
I think there's also a slippery slope here because while the game publishers obviously don't have incentive to not let their streamers stream the content, technically, you know, under the end user license agreement, they could restrict streaming of a certain game to a certain platform. And if a publisher is offered enough money, you know, they could restrict streaming of a certain game to a certain platform.
Norm bringing the EULA lawyering to bear. I mean, you're not wrong. It sucks. That sucks. That would be really awful.
And obviously, I think the backlash created by gamers.
Yeah, that's a good way to kill
your
game.
Easily kill the game.
You know what? I actually have no problem with game streamers at all because they are a unique segment.
I just fear them.
Of the online, you know, streaming community who are actually must be inherently good at what they do.
Absolutely,
they can't just be a pretty face with good camera skills or editing abilities or good with lighting or good with like communication. They have to have all of that. And most importantly, be one of the best in the world at a competitive video game, which is no easy feat. Like on the internet, forget it. So I give them full respect for that. I'm a little shocked that you can make millions of dollars at it, but
Still. A few people can make millions of dollars at it.
Good.
By and large, 99.9% of people make nothing.
It's American dream. That's all that matters.
It is now. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That does it for tech news.
Now it's time for a moment of science.
All right. I'm going to put on a visual that I just retweeted, Adam retweeted, a bunch of people retweeted. It's awesome. Go on our Twitter feeds and look at it. It is mesmerizing. This is one of the coolest pictures you will ever see. It's this. Well, Norm, why don't you describe it?
It looks like some computer generated pattern, but it looks like a macro image of like honey or something.
Oh, interesting. I was going to say that the sun. And it also reminds me of what the old demo scene might call a plasma effect. It's very cool.
Uh-huh.
So this is what we like to call the sun.
The sun.
This is the highest resolution image ever taken of the sun. That image you saw was 19,000 kilometers by 10,000 kilometers across. And you're seeing all those little orange bursts were bits of plasma that were just like roiling and boiling on the sun's surface. This came from the Daniel Inouye Solar Telescope. And this is the highest resolution image we've ever seen. So each of those bits that you saw that were sort of like bordered was the size of Texas.
Holy smokes.
So this is just a really awesome picture. Check it out. It's mesmerizing. The sun in HD. Can't beat it.
So the diameter of the Earth is 12,000 kilometers. So that's amazing.
Yeah. So that image is basically the size of the Earth. Okay. One story this week. And by the time you're listening to this, this will have already happened or not happened. So I grew up in Pittsburgh, and about 900 kilometers above Pittsburgh, Wednesday night, we got a chance for a really special event. Mm. Sandra Bullock and George Clooney would be really into this event. Because depending on who you believe, there's a 1 in 10 to 1 in 1,000 chance that two satellites are going to collide over that area. And these satellites have no way of avoiding each other at this point. They're essentially in their, you know, what's typically referred to as a graveyard orbit. So they're either going to hit each other or not. And they're moving probably around like 27,000 kilometers an hour. So when they hit each other, it's going to be instantaneous kaboom, except no explosion because they're in space, in the vacuum of space. But they're going to disintegrate. There's the two things that are going to hit is an old space telescope called the Infrared Astronomical Satellite, which is a joint mission between NASA, the Netherlands, and the UK. And it died in 1983. The other is a gravitational experiment called GGSE-4 that the Air Force launched in 1967. And this is just becoming an ongoing problem with SpaceX launching a number of Starlink satellites just this morning. This issue is going to continue to rise to be conserved because we essentially have no way of dealing with orbital debris. There's essentially two thoughts on how to deal with it. Like, we could go up there and try to like move them out, like with a net. That's really not going to work.
Can't you just push them down and they'll burn up?
Yeah. The other is a laser based idea where you essentially heat one side of the debris from Earth with a laser and essentially use that pressure that you're creating from the laser heating up to drive it towards the atmosphere and burn up. Both of those are really untested, and we don't know what to do. There's really not much in terms of how we govern the space, govern how these orbits are calculated. There's just a few sort of agencies, but no one's essentially in charge, because everyone's in charge. So this will be an interesting thing if we get, a hit. We haven't had, I don't think, an orbital collision of this magnitude since 2008.
But it has happened.
It's happened once at this scale.
I know there's a lot of debris up there, but man, that seems unlikely. That's impressive.
Space is big.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's a cool thing. And since I talked so much about the virus, I'm going to stop.
The VR Minute. virtual reality this week.
So next week's kind of exciting. I'm actually really bummed I'm not going to be in San Francisco for it, but at a conference, the SPIE conference, which I believe stands for the International Society for Optics and Photonics, super sexy, a company called Lynx is going to unveil a new VR / AR headset. It's all very cryptic.
Isn't it an all-in-one?
It is an all, I think it's a
standalone.
Standalone, yeah. Is what's revealed so far. So it's a French startup called Lynx. You can cue your California Games jokes now for the pack-in title. But it's the Lynx R1 headset.
California Games with the pack-in for the Lynx?
Yeah.
That's like, I would have bought it just for that. I didn't know that. I mean, I would have easily bought that.
Lynx was the best handheld.
If it wasn't packed in.
And California Games was, yeah.
Dude, that was an amazing port for California Games.
We all love the Lynx.
Okay, I'm just saying. I didn't know that was packed in.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure. Based on my remembering of the magazine ads Lynx.
I didn't own one, unfortunately. Obviously.
So this, though, is a headset, standalone headset, as you mentioned earlier, and it will be capable of both VR and AR, though the expectation it's going to be is primarily a VR headset with pass-through AR capability.
Hey, we've seen it before. That's a good solution.
I think it's a good solution for now. Absolutely. For you to get the most field of view.
The most opacity from your augmented images.
And also for you to actually have then an AR, or sorry, VR functionality for it, there is way more content.
Full-fledged VR.
Right now. All that matters really is just the kind of like interaction comfort. You get stereo, presumably, if you get two cameras on the outside.
Yeah.
And if there's good mapping, then you can actually blend those objects with what you're seeing in the pass-through. What do we really need for good pass-through right now? You need a good VR headset.
Low latency.
You need good frame rate.
You high frame rate and, you know, high resolution cameras.
And the cameras have to be wide angle because they have to have good image quality across the entire field of view.
Exactly. It's not easy.
Yeah.
And we haven't even seen anybody do all-in-one standalone VR as well as Oculus, let alone, you know, adding all the complexities of making an AR device as well. So
it's so funny that inside out standalone tracking used to be this holy grail for VR. And now it seems like it's just something you can do. You know, Windows Mixed Reality's done it for a long time.
Right.
Obviously, on the Oculus side, that's what they're betting on.
Oh, yeah.
No cameras. And it's the
pros definitely outweigh the cons, for
yes,
sure.
Yes. So it's going to be February 3rd at the conference in San Francisco. It's going to be a live stream.
It's only a 20-minute segment of the conference. Like, this is not like the event of the day. It's just embedded in the middle of the day. We'll be following it. It's interesting.
They say they have innovative ergonomics. Fine. That's useful. But optics as
what does
well.
That mean?
That's why it's comfortable. It's got to be comfortable.
Integrated or
innovative.
Innovative. Okay. Gotcha.
I can imagine it means that the compute is going to be on the back of the headset. On the back of the headband,
like the Quest prototype,
and they'll have maybe a better balance for some reason.
A lot of people wish it was like that on the Quest today.
Why isn't it?
Your guess is as good as mine. Maybe costs. Maybe it was easier to put it all together
because then you'd have to have cables, power, and battery also on the back of the headset. And you would be less portable, less collapsible. Mm-hmm. They probably couldn't get away with their the rubber straps that you have on the Quest. You need something more rigid, mm-hmm. And which may be what they're going with. Again, with the assumption that the ergonomics are going in that direction. But innovative optics as well. I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, what's that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean? We'll see.
All right,
we'll see. I'm interested.
Yeah, the more the merrier.
Yep. On the VR side, there's a report now that since the announcement of Half-Life Alyx, we are now almost just a month away, till March at least. Don't know when in March it's going to come out though.
Yeah.
But since they announced it, the Index has doubled in sales.
Yes.
And this is not a report from Valve. This is from a tracking firm, Superdata. But they say that Valve has sold about 100,000 units.
103. Up from 46 before the announcement.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I mean, I'm sure that it did a lot for all VR headsets. that are PC compatible, because you know that any of them will be able to play the game. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting to me is that the most expensive one sold out. Like that, they probably would have sold more than this had they actually had the stock to satisfy
them. A lot of people are critiquing Valve's ability to meet demand, and I'm sure there are internal discussions there about ways to meet demand, meet support. I mean, yeah. They, I don't think in the long run, are in the business of making headsets. They would love for VR to take off as a whole. But this is a great number because we know everyone who bought this, all 103,000 people who've bought an Index, are going to be playing VR. This is not a device that's going to sit in your cupboard and sit in your drawer. When Alex comes out, mm-hmm. they're going to play it.
Yes.
And so the larger that number gets, it means the larger actual active VR user base.
Well, they all get it for free.
And they all get it for free.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yes, VR games also cost money, but like people bought this headset with the intention to play games on the reg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder who the people, why they chose the Index. Like, was it because it had the best audio? Was it because the wide field of view?
Was it purely because Valve made it?
Or was it because it's not a Facebook product? Like, I bet that was a factor for a lot of people.
I was going to say not even that, but because they're associating the company that made the game with the company that made the headset.
Mm. You know, yeah, and they just trust Valve.
And they just trust that might be, if they developed it on Index, that's going to be their preferred way to play it.
Right.
Even though, as I can attest, it works great on other headsets too.
Yeah, right.
There's a video about it.
You're one of the few that can.
Yeah. I think we're all hoping that anyone who buys an Index now will get it in time to, and there'll be opportunity to buy it in time to play Alex. Or, you know, it's totally fine. You're going to be able to play it with an Oculus Quest or a Rift S, and there's no reason. And you can play all your Steam VR games in that as well.
The same Superdata company, they had estimated numbers on the Quest as well, which I thought was interesting.
What did they say?
The Quest, they figure, moved 317,000 units during the holiday quarter alone.
I'm not surprised. It's been sold out for months, it feels like.
Yeah.
Do you think does that sound low or high to you in terms of expectations or what VR needed?
I mean, I can't judge the actual number. I can only judge the experience that at Christmas time, a lot of people that I don't talk about VR with were asking me, like, what do you think about this Quest thing? Should I get it? It's sold out. There's something here. There was like a little buzz about it.
So it's a total of 705,000 since it launched, which is pales compared to PSVR still,
mm-hmm.
you know, which mm-hmm. is millions. I want to say like 4 or 5 million sold PSVR.
Like, based on this tracking, if by Oculus Connect in 9 months, there's no way, if this is accurate, there's no way they wouldn't have sold 1 million Quest units by Oculus Connect this year in September,
right.
Fall, right?
So again, it's a stock issue, partially.
But assuming they're on the same production trends as they had for this holiday season, mm-hmm. ramped up to match demand, you know, I think it's safe to say they would have surpassed 1 million units sold. If Mark Zuckerberg came up on stage and said, we sold 1 million Quests in the past year and a half since it came out, you know, mid-2019 to fall 2020, I think that would sound like a disappointment.
I do too. Yeah, I do too. But that's only because expectations are unrealistic. Like, this is a brand new thing. Unfortunately,
it's marketed as a mainstream device.
The VR discussion is embedded in this larger gaming discussion. And the gaming industry is bigger than the movie industry. Like, it's just enormous. It's untouchably large.
And you could even say it's the VR discussion that's embedded from Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook's perspective in a computing discussion, because then the money that they're banking on is that this is the final computing platform. And so it's even apt to make the comparison to iPhone, iPad as a whole new way to interact. And while games are primarily the thing that people are doing on it now.
Yeah, you don't want to compare it to the iPhone either.
You don't, 100%. No, that's even worse. It's even a worse
exactly.
comparison.
So yeah, it's a difficult thing, but I think in the context of VR itself, if we can just isolate that as a discussion and realize that we are in the early days.
But we can't step back. If you're spending money on ads, if you're spending money on TV ads, national TV ads, billboards. It's tough to walk back and say
the million units sold days would be disappointing. But on the other hand, it's way beyond what they expected. So it's not disappointing internally. I think to them, they're on track. It's another one of those long tail kind of things. Like, they're looking years ahead.
I think hardware units sold doesn't tell the full story, because I'm sure a lot of those PSVR units are just gathering dust right now.
Yeah.
So there has to be some equivalent of the daily active users we hear about every day for apps for what this looks like, that I think is more indicative, because if they create a really strong, vocal, passionate minority that is showing growth over time, that's probably better than selling a million units out the gate that are just going to sit there and gather dust.
Yeah, you might buy the Quest so you could play a more mainstream targeted title like Vader Immortal, because you like Star Wars and you want to use lightsabers in VR, but people are staying in Quests for things like Pavlov.
On side quest. Yeah.
And once that hits, if that hits.
Yeah, the store.
The store. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing that can create retention.
Yeah, I wonder, have they... Because it's not their title. It's not an Oculus Studios title.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're really aware of like what that will do to their sales.
I really hope, maybe some of them are listening to the podcast, that they're aware of that, that they don't undervalue the potential of the Counter-Strike of VR.
Right.
And what Counter-Strike did for PC gaming and PCs in the late 90s, early 2000s, in 2000, 20 years ago. You know, it created a generation of people who were then enthusiastic about playing competitive multiplayer games, building PCs, mm-hmm. and building communities, that without Counter-Strike, there is no Overwatch. There is no Call of Duty.
Stop it. No Overwatch. That's more TF2. Do you think TF2 came out of Counter-Strike?
I mean,
because TFC was around before.
And guess what? TFC did not. The communities, and this all goes back to like Tribes, right? Tribes a game.
Yeah.
Tribes, Counter-Strike. Battlefield.
Yeah.
And then, yes, TF2, but people didn't just start playing online competitive shooters with TF2. People migrated TF2 from things like Counter-Strike. And they existed concurrently, but it was the networks and it was things like Ventrilo and all the communication networks that were built and the forum communities that were built around Counter-Strike that allowed competitive multiplayer shooters to really flourish.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what Pavlov could be. No pressure. On Pavlov.
I think Pavlov's got it nailed already. They just got to fix matchmaking and friends.
And build content.
Yeah, exactly. Build content, maybe tweak the looks of the maps a little bit, but it's all my son wants to play.
Every night. I'm going to give a recommendation again. We did a kind of early impressions video for The Walking Dead, Saints and Sinners. I know it's not your cup of tea, Jeremy, because it is a little bit scary. There are moments of scariness, but at least in 2020, it's one of my favorite VR games.
What?
So far.
Really?
I'm so into this game.
Why?
You can watch my video, but we really didn't talk about Boneworks, and I have a little still am thinking through Boneworks, because Boneworks did not get me in the same way that it got a lot of people. Like, I appreciate that they created a game where every objects, the physics object,
even your body,
collision models, and you're super satisfying to have all this emergent gameplay in VR. But as a game itself, it lacked a polish, it lacked a purpose and a point, and it really, I think, is better as a sandbox. Mm. And there's some problems like saving. You know, you can only save per level. You know, so some parts of the game that got me frustrated.
So, what's the purpose and point of Walking Dead?
Well, it's a zombie survival game. It's a survivor horror game.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what you're talking about is almost an existential question now. What's the point?
And while it does not have the interactiveness of Boneworks, it does have physics-based interaction. So you're grabbing things, pushing things away, has simulated weight. So you're using two hands to pull heavy heavy objects like exploding canisters and rolling them and throwing them.
Single player only.
This is a game that would be so good. And developers have said they're open-minded, but probably won't happen as a multiplayer survival game.
And this is PC only, right?
No.
It's on Quest?
It will be on Quest later this year, and it will be on PSVR
later
this year with cross-buy if you buy it on the Oculus Store, which I'm really curious how it's going to work on Quest, how it's going to look, because visually it also looks fantastic. But they have not only great interactions where you are great inventory system, free locomotion, grappling, you're climbing up sides of buildings to get inside houses, scavenging using a flashlight. There's that great sense of dread in the environment because, you know, these walkers are, if you're fighting them one at a time, you are pretty safe, but your weapons also break over time, and there's a stamina system. So if you don't have, haven't built up your stamina, you can only kill so many of these walkers in a row before you actually get tired and the vignetting closes in on you, and then you become more vulnerable to the attack. So it's a little bit of that stamina management and energy management in the game, which I think works well. But the way they've constructed this, not exactly open world, but at least open game, open story design, where you can drop into these levels, these like four or five New Orleans city blocks and explore, but you have a ticking timer on your watch. And that might be the best part of the game, where you have about this, like, I want to say 20 minutes to half hour in real time, while this stopwatch clicks down, and once it, and you get a notification every like every 15 minutes in real time, and once it hits zero, the bell tower rings, and then all the walkers start swarming, and you got to complete all the mission objectives in that time and get out of there. And some of the best parts of the game is as you get closer, and I'm not finished with all the mission objectives, and I'm trying to get out of an increasingly swarmed area and dense zombie area.
Yep.
That's the best part.
That's the best.
It's so fun. It's so terrifying.
You start getting beaten
reckless.
Down.
You're reckless. You're panicking.
Your stamina starts dropping.
Yeah. And I'm less in control. I'm missing reloads.
That sounds awful.
Yeah, you want to play that? I don't know.
Super stressful in the best way.
I mean, like, awful, not in a, like, that sounds like, you know, reasonable design, consistent with the story.
Yeah.
Awful.
What
wow.
What are you doing in that pregame phase? You're searching for weapons?
It's not the game phase weapon. Like, during the game, there are still walkers in the area, but they're easy to avoid, or you can kill them one at a time, but there's a ticking clock for completing the objectives and scavenging and finding as much as you can in these empty houses.
Is there a difficulty settings?
No difficulty settings.
Have you beaten it?
I'm very close. Yeah, it's about 15 hours. I'm like,
oh my gosh,
12 hours in.
Oh, right, but now. So you like one of those cities where you complete the objective. How long does that take?
That's actually really great. You can play that for like an hour and finish it. Huh. You know, 45 minutes and finish a mission, and that's a good play session.
Okay.
Or fail. And if you fail and there's no mid-game, mid-mission saves, you have a chance to try again and get your loot. But if you die twice, you lose all your loot and you got to load back again. So it's actually, it's paced really well.
Okay.
For you to play, you know, for one mission a night. The developers have addressed two of the issues that I talked about in the video. One is the angle of the pistol relative to the angle of your controller. That's now adjustable. I think every shooter should have that option. Pistol Whip does a great job of that, letting you tweak and adjust for your preference. And also the ability to physically crouch. Right now, because it supports seated play and it will support PSVR, it's a button to crouch. But there's a way you can tweak an INI file and then you can actually physically crouch and have your character model crouch.
Oh, you can.
Yeah.
There's a big to-do about that on the Steam forums.
Yeah.
All right. Good.
Yeah. Autica.
Harmonix's
music rhythm shooting game.
Shooting rhythm action game is now available on your Oculus Quest.
And the real hook here is the musicians, right, that are a part of this. Because the gameplay, we've seen something similar to this before. But if the music is awesome, the weapon types are engaging, that's where you get the value, right? Okay.
I don't know. The game's been on PC for a while.
Yeah, it didn't really hook me the same way that Pistol Whip hooked me. I think you need to be a little bit more precise.
Did you like the music? Because it's like Iggy Azalea, David Guetta.
I'm not that type of person. I wanted the John Wick simulator, and
Marshmallow.
I got it with Pistol Whip.
Dead Mouse.
Yeah. You know what? I have the same problem with both games, Pistol Whip and Autica. Whatever it is about rhythm action games like Beat Saber or Guitar Hero, which I both love, I don't have the same relationship with these two shooting games. And I don't know if that's because I'm not touching the thing that I'm supposed to be doing, like the bar that crosses the line. That
there's no musical instrument analog.
Like if it's not like percussive in the physical sense, or if I just don't think this pulling a trigger is enough of a movement to accentuate that moment.
To feel, feel the beat.
Right. Maybe I like to, there's an element of like being able to dance. And you can certainly do that in pistol whip, but the actual firing of your gun doesn't necessarily, you don't have to do, you're not forced to.
Would that feel different if you had haptic feedback? If you had like a recoil?
Who knows?
Yeah. But also music is different because it's, the beat is so subjective where you feel like you want
spoken like a true like a white man. What do you mean the beat is subjective?
I mean the places in a song where you feel you connect most with the beat drops is a personal preference.
What?
And that's I guess it's,
well, I'm talking about just like the where you
the act this straight up action.
Yeah, like you're playing on the beat of, on the rhythm of the downbeat of the whatever the time signature is usually.
That's not as satisfying to me as you know as. I get what you're saying, and I have had that experience with Pistol Whip as well, where I...
Like Will Smith didn't even play it as a rhythm action game, and he loves the game.
Yeah, I don't... Most of the time, I don't play it as a rhythm action game either, because if I get in that mindset...
So you're not playing for score then?
I get the score,
yeah,
but it's the visual more than the audio that's aligning me to the timing. It's, the audio doesn't always align with when I want... I feel like this is a good time to fire.
Hmm. Do you like rhythm action games? Dance Dance Revolution?
No.
Guitar Hero?
I mean, but I like Beat Saber, though, which is which is a rhythm action game, right?
Totally.
So, historically not, but I really like Beat Saber. To me, it's the music. If I like the music, I can get into those games.
That's true. That is an important aspect.
That does it for this week's podcast. I will be out next week.
Hey, if you have ideas of what you want Jeremy and I to do when Norm's gone, let us know.
Or we'll find a way for me to maybe dial in from
family,
the resistance.
Your family would allow that?
From the line?
It might be a 2-hour line.
Wow.
That would be cool. Almost assuredly will be.
Right?
That will definitely not end well for you.
I'll get some AirPods. I'll pop them in. Could Skype me out. Give some play-by-play. On the line attraction.
Still in line, guys.
Still in line. Hey, someone's peeing in the corner right there. It's really awkward.
There's a lot of outros.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
People have come out of the woodwork. This is great.
Let's go with that Jean-Luc one.
Is that the one I clicked?
I don't know.
I was going to do this one. Which one's the Jean-Luc one?
We have a Picard one. We didn't talk about Picard this week because we were saving it for next week, so we're not getting ahead of the release schedule to give y'all there a chance to watch the episode for a week. And we will have some graphics. Someone reached out to us on Twitter with some amazing red alert and even yellow alert graphics for spoiler warnings.
Yellow alert.
Yellow alert. Come on, you got to be prepared, spoilers? Man. Yeah. What are you...
Discussing the show without spoilers?
You can't have
spoilers?
Red alert without yellow alert. Wow. What are you doing?
I haven't heard that register from you before.
There's a procedure here. So we'll be using those graphics. Maybe not. I'll get them over to you guys if you wanted to use it next week, but definitely next time I'll be on the show.
Yeah, because next week we are going to start discussing the Picard episodes. Did you explain all that?
I did.
We were talking.
I know.
All right.
I know.
All right, so this is by Black Powder Engine. Tested theme. Picard. Maybe this is a new intro. I don't even know. I haven't listened to it yet.
Hi there. I didn't see you.
Tested.
Picard, Star Trek Discovery. Star Trek Picard, DS9, Star Trek DS9, Discovery, Star Trek Into Darkness. Picard, Star Trek Discovery, Star Trek Beyond, Dominion War, Borg Technology, The Enterprise, DS9.
Okay.
Picard, Lower Decks, Section 31, the Star Trek TV universe, the Narada, Romulan homeworld, Spock, Summit Nova, Romulus destroyed.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Picard.
That's it.
Wow.
Alrighty. Thanks.
There it is.
See you next time.